I'm so glad to see you this morning. I hope you're happy to be here. Early voting began this weekend in Maryland. The lines at the League for People with Disabilities backed up for hours yesterday. For those of us who are accustomed to volunteering at the polls on Election Day, this extended period is a boon. We can be sure that our people get to the polls. We have a little more time. We can start earlier. We can start pestering sooner. The threat of us continuing to pester for days may get people out. We can get them rides. We can get them to encourage their friends to vote. Early voting is a boon in that there are fewer polling locations that need to be covered by volunteers. But of course, there's a great challenge because there are also these long hours, day after day, that we need to have people there. I have a little parenthetical here. I know that Scott McCloud is hoping to deliver a 60-second, count 'em, commercial break later in the service to encourage you all to volunteer. Don't say I didn't warn you. Have we, in Maryland, redefined marriage? That's part of the question that is being asked. Has this law, which has been passed, has been signed by our governor, will go into effect on January 1st, has it radically altered what marriage is in our society? Well, I'm going to say, of course not. Let me tell you a story. This week, Charles, who I don't see here today, called and was a little upset, and he said, I've been looking at the law online, and it's confusing. And I said, give me a minute. Tell me what page you're on, and I'll look it up too. And we looked at it, and the way that it's posted, there are brackets that they don't tell you are places where you lift out, and then they're all caps, which are where you insert. So it doesn't make any sense because it says both that it's a man and a woman and that it's not a man and a woman, unless you know how to read it. So we had a good time talking to each other about it, but indeed, when you look at the law, it doesn't change a thing. It says one person may not marry their grandmother, grandfather, mother, father, brother, sister, daughter. It just has a list of people you may not marry. All right? And then it goes through, you know, all the basic stuff, but it's all the same. Nothing has been changed except, instead of saying a man may not marry his mother, that an individual may not marry that individual's blah, 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 and that two individuals may marry each other. That's all, that's the whole of the change. So has it been redefined? Of course not. But then there's another way of looking at it. Have we in Maryland redefined marriage? And of course we have. Of course we have. The marriages we are describing look like just everybody else's marriages. When we're talking about having children and buying homes and participating in the means of economic production as owners or as workers or as consumers. But the marriages we look for are marriages that in their very existence say that the social difference between men and women is exactly that, a social construct, not an innate difference. And especially in terms of the social construct, because we value the one who makes the money over the one who raises the children, and because of the long-term pattern of it being the men who make the money and the women who care for the children, in our social construct, we value men over women. And same-sex relationships ask a whole bunch of questions about that. And I want to tell you, I love a couple, my next door neighbors in Michigan, Lucy and Linda. And Lucy and Linda have two boys, Robert and Andre. And They get the question all the time. When they finally get close to people, people say, "So who's the guy?" Give me a break. And I love the conversation that comes short of a pump in the nose. Linda, if you were to just look at them, Linda was a naval officer. If you look, she has really short hair. She's tough. And if one were to look at it, one would say, well, Linda must be the guy. Lucy is a professor who wears makeup and jewelry and who has a little voice that goes around like this. And you'd have to say that Lucy is the gal. Except, who makes the money? Lucy makes the money. She's a tenured professor. And Linda works part-time as a social worker and raises the kids. And so this whole question of who's the guy, which is an absurd question, but a great question to ask, if you ask it another way, who is more valued? And from that, who can behave what ways in the world? We're redefining marriage because those same-sex couples can't be defined in those ways. You can't say that somebody's the guy. You can't say that someone's the gal. If they make a decision to behave in certain ways and whatever, they can. But the relationship by itself challenges what marriage is and challenges this question of who's more equal in this world and who's more valued in our social construct. Marriage is being redefined. Now, this is not the first time that marriage has been redefined. If we look back at Judaism, Judaism had had a complicated understanding of marriage and divorce, of what the relationships within a kinship group allowed, about what problems there were if you were to marry outside. This is a great question. It happens in lots of societies. How do you keep the group together? How do you keep our identity with one another? What do you risk by marrying outside? And it's led to all kinds of complicated social setups about what incest might look like, what polygamy might look like, what marrying an outsider might result in. It wasn't even until the medieval period that the single union of one Jewish man and one Jewish woman became the norm. And not until late in the medieval period that Jews registered their marriages with civil authorities. Marriage was not an issue of the state to that kinship group. Marriage was an issue to be decided upon in the community of faith. Now, the Romans had had a very simple and functional arrangement around marriage and divorce. The woman brought the dowry, the man brought social prestige, and at any point, either party could say enough, and essentially the woman took the dowry, and the men got the kids. And that was the arrangement. And it was very clear about how the property was to be divided. It was very clear about what inheritance looked like and what bloodlines were. But it was a simple, simple, civil arrangement. And it didn't have a kinship group religious expression at all. The state religion did certain things, but in terms of the question of marriage, the state religion was just not interested. For the Romans, it was a simple civil question. As the Christian church rose to power, it was very confused. It needed to reconcile this Jewish background that said this is an issue of our religion, and this Roman background that said this is an issue of the state, and for 1,000 years it was confused. Marriage had been a civic institution. As the Roman Empire expanded and as more kinship groups were brought in to the empire, for example, Germanic and Gothic parts of the Holy Roman Empire had traditions of kinship where it was a chief with multiple wives who headed things. And so the church had to say, what if this is the state? What if this is the church? What if this is permissible? What if this needs to be abandoned? And so it was centuries before the sacrament of holy matrimony was established. And that became the sacrament for most of the people that was equivalent to the sacrament of ordination for priests and of holy orders for people who were becoming nuns and monks. Marriage and divorce were defined and redefined as circumstances changed. And again, most notably as people moved from the countryside, where a huge family was a good thing to have, to being in the city, where production by artisans and exchanges by merchants required much smaller families. As recently as 50 years ago, the Catholic Church redefined marriage. You may not know this, but I learned this last night when I went to Mass. I went to St. Vincent de Paul Roman Catholic Church, a friendly church to us, where Father Lawrence was going to preach a sermon that said, while our bishop tells us that we should vote against question 6, a thinking Catholic may make a different choice. Because the Pope didn't say don't vote on question 6. It was the bishop. And the bishop does not speak with papal infallible authority. The bishop is the counselor to his flock. And so Father Lawrence said, 50 years ago Vatican II happened. And we went into Vatican II knowing that marriage was primarily about procreation and secondarily about the upbuilding of the partners. And in Vatican II, they said, marriage is about both biology and healthy relationship between the partners. So it was no longer, this is what marriage is really about, and we have this thing on the side, but it was redefined to say marriage is about happiness. So people have been redefining marriage for a long time, and it changes. And we're happy that it changes. But what does this mean for our church and for our people? I'm going to be a little bit away from the subject for a second, and I hope you'll go with me. The fact that I and a few friends went down to hear Father Lawrence, we had heard about it 6 weeks ago. He asked us not to tell the media, it was between him and his congregation. This was not going to be a sideshow. He, in the service, by the way, read the entire letter from the bishop and didn't take it apart, didn't challenge it point by point or anything like that, but told a different Catholic teaching. It was very simple, respectful, and he said, you're smart people and you can figure out what you want to do. Say your prayers, listen to your heart, vote your conscience. But the fact that we went down to be with St. Vincent is to say that in our relationships across religions, there are going to be places where we have difference, there are going to be places where we have agreement. St. Vincent's is one of our colleague churches in Bridge, Baltimore Regional Initiative Developing Genuine Equality. In Bridge and in all kinds of religious settings right now, churches are questioning their positions about the role of gay folk. Younger evangelicals see anti-gay bigotry by their elders as a reason not to go to church. Younger evangelicals are finding ways to create different congregations. Some of them meet in bars on a Thursday night. Some of them meet online, but they don't feel that what they perceive as bigoted responses of their elders, and especially bigoted responses of the elders that are meant to apply to the whole of society, as being consistent with this Jesus man that they love. This Rabbi Jesus and his posse, that the message that they have is not consistent with saying that we should hate gay people, not allow them to be married, and impose that on a society. Interestingly, not all ready to be gay affirming, fewer are interested in being gay condemning, and one Pentecostal pastor with whom I went to a national training for a week, placed it this way when he spoke to me: your sexuality is between you and God. He had a deep concern for me, and that concern was about my eternal salvation, and I told him not to worry about that. We need to be present in places where people disagree with us, to be who we are, so that the truth of who we are may change the people around us and the conditions around us. We need to be present as an equal partner in organizations such as Bridge, if our church is to have an effective vehicle for addressing the lives of the most needy. It will include some direct service work, I'm sure, some work which is charitable work, I'm sure, some work which is advocacy and organizational work. But if we are about to be about the transformation of our society so that there is a broader social justice culture that will not allow the needs of the most needy to be sidelined, we need to be part of a larger movement that is not only advocating for people around their issues, but actually giving people the tools with which they may fight their battles, and where we may be with them fighting those battles. I believe the best mechanism that we have for this kind of work would be an organization like Bridge. Being out, gay and lesbian and bisexual people in an interreligious setting is not easy. Introducing one's partner as husband or wife startles people when it's the same gender relationship. It challenges their old assumptions. It upsets their biases. But if you're in an organization where you're expected to be one with one another around important issues, the person can't just invisibilize you, rub you out, ignore the truth of who you are. You're going to be there, present. Here I am. And you're going to experience them for who they are. And hopefully, we both are changed. We challenge the old ways of looking at the world. We show up with our own inherent worth and dignity. We expect and respect the inherent worth and dignity that they bring. We value one another, and we begin to establish a new normal, a place where, as you've heard me say before, people are able to see us as people beyond their institutions' prejudices. I've told you the story of Lucy and Linda, who is the guy. This is also the family that provided a turning point in the relationship of my church in Flint with its community organization, because it was in a Catholic church with a Black Baptist minister leading the meeting, and he said, "We value the Unitarian Universalists," with whom he has lots of disagreement, by the way, "and their commitment to public education. And we started down this path because of one family, Lucy, Linda, Robert, Andre." That he was able to see them as a family. That he was able to say publicly, "I value their faith," was a big step forward for us claiming a place in that organization and being leaders in its effectiveness. In the case of Bridge, what you will see on Friday night, if you are there, are two pages in an advertising booklet that salute my election as a co-chair of Bridge. Well, I'm pleased to have been asked, and I will work to get out of that relationship everything I can for First Unitarian Church. And I believe it's in Bridge's interest to make us, to help us be the strongest church that we can in our witness in the city. But what is more important to me is the fact that there will be this full-page salute that comes from Unitarian Universalists, from this church, and we're going to be proclaiming that we are absolutely the equal of everybody else in the place in a way that's normal and attractive and desirable. Our allies in the UU Legislative Ministry, our allies in the UUs for Social Justice, the vocal and vibrant participation of people in this congregation, no one is going to allow Bridge to say that the Unitarian Universalists aren't valuable. And the second full-page notice that you'll see are words of congratulations from New Wave Singers of Baltimore and the Baltimore Men's Chorus, an ad that clearly identifies these as gay and LGBT and straight allies organizations, and identifies two of the congregations where they are received and celebrated and will be doing concerts, First Unitarian Church and St. Vincent Roman Catholic Parish. This is a moment for us and for our values to say that we embrace gay and lesbian and bisexual people, that we welcome trans people and gender nonconforming people, that we are known as a place that supports marriage equality. This will be a challenge to the way that things have been done in Bridge in its first 10 years, and will indicate our strong desire to work with other people to build a broader justice coalition that can fight powerfully and jubilantly and effectively for the uplifting of our whole social system. Now here's a challenge to you. In 2 weeks, we're going to be here celebrating. We are going to win this election, and we are going to be here to celebrate. Now here's a funny coincidence. What's happening on November 11th? It's the centenary of when the spiritual leader of the Baha'i faith was in Baltimore and spoke in our parish hall. And there are going to be 75 Baha'is joining us for worship that morning. And it's going to be cool and great and wonderful. But the fact of the matter is, the Baha'is think that their gay and lesbian members need to be celibate. That's their religious position. Not unlike most religious positions. I mean, this is not an unusual thing in the world. So we're going to be here celebrating, and we're going to be having guests with us who may disagree with us. So I asked the organizing committee over the past couple of weeks, what's that going to feel like for you? They are smart people. I said, you know, we believe that there have been at least 9 incarnations of the divine. We believe that Baha'u'llah is the final incarnation. Not all those incarnations see the world the same way. Not all of those religions live in the world the same way. It's not my job as a Baha'i to tell a Muslim how to live, or a Zoroastrian how to live, or a Christian how to live. It's my job to tell a Baha'i how a Baha'i should live. So we're used to knowing that our social ethics are our social ethics, and knowing that it's not our role to impose our social ethics on somebody else. I thought that was really kind of something. There was a generosity in those words expressed to us. They were clear that there are separations between church and state, that there are separations among religious practices that must be protected, and that really what really matters is that we work for the full equality of men and women, which is a central tenet of their faith, for the unity of humankind in all its ethnicities, a central tenet of their faith, and for the harmony of religion in the pursuit of world peace. And I told him about that. I don't think we'll have any problems. We live at an incredible moment in the life of our state and of our country. This congregation, long in the forefront of the struggle for the recognition of the full humanity of bisexual and lesbian and gay people of many gender expressions, this congregation has so much to be proud of. The work that you have been doing for years and have been doing for the past few weeks is an amazing work. We are 10 days away, friends, from the decisive affirmation of what we have struggled for so long. My prayer, love, universal and all-conquering, love, powerful and all-embracing, love, generous and compassionate, may love move in our hearts in the next 10 days. May love move in the hearts of all the people who go to the polls, who encounter us in our person, standing there proclaiming our humanity, saying that we identify with this as a matter of faith. Fairness and equality in marriage, protections for all families. This is where we stand. Love moves us to this position. Love moves among us. Love delivers us the deep desires of our hearts, and even marriage equality. May love move among us and grant us peace. Amen.